Welcome to Steppin' Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms not only within the system, but within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon. Hi, everybody. My name's Sue Supriano, and today my guest is Ed Brown. Ed Brown lives in Atlanta, Georgia, and he's the brother of Iman Jamil Alamin, who was formerly known as H. Rap Brown during civil rights times, and H. Rap Brown became a Muslim and is now a leader in the Muslim community and is now in prison in Atlanta, Georgia, and that's what we're going to be talking about here. Ed Brown, as I said, is Jamil Alamin's brother, and I want to welcome you, Ed. I'm really happy to meet you, and I know that you have come out here to the West Coast to educate people about what's going on with your brother and get support for his case, because it seems that he is clearly a political prisoner. And so I'd like to start out, before we get more into what's going on with Jamil, to hear a little bit about yourself. I have the impression that you were very much an activist also in the 60s, and maybe you still are.
Well, thank you very much. In the 60s, I was a young activist. I'm an old activist now, but an activist nonetheless. And thank you for inviting me to come to your program. Yes, I was involved from the early 60s in terms of the sit-in movement, the wave of sit-ins that kind of swept across the South. I was kind of in that wave, and that propelled me into a kind of life of activism.
You're from Louisiana.
I'm from Louisiana. I was born in Baton Rouge and raised in Baton Rouge. I attended school at Southern University, and I was unceremoniously put out of there because of my movement activities. And then I re-enrolled at Howard University and continued my activist kind of bent while I was in Washington, D.C.
This was focusing on
racism, particularly on the demise of the American apartheid system. It was the attempt to destroy all of the vestiges of the segregated society. I grew up at a time of rigid segregation. My generation was the impatient generation, decided that enough was enough and that we're not prepared to live under those oppressive conditions any longer. And therefore, we then took matters into our own hands and launched a program of direct action. That is to say, deliberately violating the segregation laws, provoking arrest, and therefore challenging the system, both politically and legally, with regard to its legitimacy and ultimately in terms of its existence. Leaving Washington, I then went away to Mississippi in 1963-64 for Freedom Summer. Freedom Summer was a summer in which there were a number of white volunteers that came to Mississippi in order to do voter registration work, to work in freedom schools, and basically become involved in movement activity. And did that for several years, left in 1986 to go back to Washington. I worked for the Walter Reuther and the UAW, had a program called Citizens Crusades Against Poverty, which was an attempt to try and force the enhancement of much of the poverty legislation so that it would have a greater impact in the communities that were the targets of that program. But realized I'd really left my heart in Mississippi and went back to Mississippi, started a human resource development program there, worked for a number of years, ultimately moved to New York, worked there as a consultant for several foundations, made my way to New Orleans and then to Atlanta, where I worked on the Voter Education Project, which was the oldest voting rights organization in the country that had the responsibility and indeed lived up to the responsibility of registering millions of African Americans, newly enfranchised African Americans in the South, and resulted in the tremendous kind of change in terms of the participation of African Americans in the political process. Then became involved in doing work overseas on elections issues in countries that were in transition from authoritarian regimes to more democratic regimes, and then that, and there we are.
Well, that's very interesting, and of course I can't help but ask you, since you're talking about voting and governments in transition, about before we start getting more into the issue of, because it's all connected, of course, into the issue of your brother as a political prisoner accused of murder, what are you, we'll just put that on a hold for a second, but don't tune out, folks. Anyway, I have to ask you about what, having worked so hard for African-American people and all people to be able to vote, and for more democracy in this country, where what you are and seeing other countries, and if we had endless time, I'd really like to ask you about which other countries and all kinds of questions. But of course, we are here right now. We've just had this election and all this recounting of votes, and well, people have. What is your opinion? What's your take on what's just gone on in this country, the United States?
Well, I think what we have seen in this country is what amounts to what used to be called a putsch, a political putsch, or a kind of, as somebody described it, a bloodless coup d'etat. It was an illegitimate seizure of power by both a combination of a ruthless scorched-the-earth policy on the part of George Bush and the team that was around him, and the archaic system that thwarts the will, the true will, of the American electorate by filtering it through this arcane process called the Electoral College. The two of them combined and converged and therefore denied the American public in the exercise of its political will. In one of the things that I, the two comments that I'll make about it, one, with regard to my work overseas, many of the places where I have worked that have been in transition should offer to organize an elections mission here to the United States as elections observers in terms of the next election process. Two is that it's hard, it's the height of hypocrisy for the United States to go around and offer itself as the world's greatest example of the democratic process. And then on the other hand, end up engaged in the practice that we just witnessed of the denial of the basic principles that are involved in the democratic tradition. And that basic principle is that freedom, that people have the freedom to choose their leaders, and that everybody should be accorded an equal opportunity of one person, one vote in the choice of those leaders. That did not prevail here. That does need to be electoral reform. They have let the genie out of the bottle, so to speak. And I think that unless people, the American people themselves, rise up and demand that there be a true exercise of the democratic process here, then I think we're in for a long nightmare of these kinds of activities where power ceases to have its legitimacy in the base of the people.
Mm-hmm. And it was particularly African-American people whose votes, who didn't get to vote, right? And there were all kinds of shenanigans that you know more about than I do. And you live close to Florida. Were you down there?
I wasn't in Florida. I was close enough to Florida, though. You know, these things end up having a ripple effect. I remember in the literature during the post-Reconstruction period, there was a time when we ended up where states began to systematically disenfranchise African Americans, and not too long thereafter.
Well, even on this quiet street, we have sirens. Go ahead, Ed Brown.
And even thereafter, what we found is that. And the fact that you had one state which began the process of disenfranchising African Americans, namely the state of Mississippi, pretty soon all of the states of the old Confederacy had created barriers for black political participation in the process. We hope that doesn't happen again. We hope history doesn't repeat itself. But for those people who are not eternally vigilant about their rights and their freedom, then history can very well repeat itself.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know when I heard about that, I thought, oh my God, this sounds like old times in terms of not being able to vote, as if it never happened, the civil rights movement. And I'm sure that this kind of thing must have been going on all these years. It's just not, I mean, I'm not sure, but I would guess. Is that so?
I think so. I think this kind of election kind of ripped the sheet off, as they say. And we saw the exercise of naked power without all of the kind of trappings of a genteel kind of political process. We saw the brutal iron fist in terms of power that was determined to ram its will down the people's throat, regardless of what the political process in terms of the outcome of the election said.
And racism was very mixed in there.
Racism is pervasive. It is mixed in everything. I mean, there's hardly an issue that you can talk about where racism still does not have a presence. So, yes, it was very much involved and very much the backdrop in terms of the political activities that we saw surrounding this election.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ed Brown, speaking of racism and iron fists, I think that all of this makes a perfectly good transition to talk about what has happened to your brother, Iman Jamil Al-Amin, who was formerly called Rap Brown, H. Rap Brown, and is still, needless to say, the same person with a little different... you talk about that. Is it a different focus in his life? And now he's sitting in prison in Atlanta, Georgia.
If you know Jamil, there are certain basic traits in terms of his character which prevail regardless of whether or not he's described as a political militant, a black power advocate, or whether or not in his current situation that he's a Muslim, Imam Jamil Abdullah Al-Amin. It doesn't make any difference. You're basically talking about the same person. I think that the focus in terms of the struggle may very well change. In the early 60s, he sought to bring about significant change in the oppression of African Americans. Today, he is still concerned about that oppression. He also understands, however, that... he understands, however, that we in the 60s attempted to become like the very people that we were fighting. We were attempting to emulate them. We were not really trying to create a new society as much as become a part of the old, same old polluted society, the same old structures. And so that he decided that in his own life, he had to search for an alternative way of creating a new society, a society which truly represented an interest in justice, in truth, and in equality, and in terms of the humanity of every person. And so that's where he is, and that's what he struggled for. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, this is a society that does not take kindly to people who challenge the basic tenets of its organization and its existence. And so therefore, while he had been seen as a rebel and a revolutionary and someone involved in resistance in the 60s, he was even seen as more of a rebel and a revolutionary and someone involved in resistance when he attempted when he embraced Islam and attempted to try and purport its basic tenets as a way for reorganizing the society.
Mm-hmm. Well, we should tell the story, or if you would tell the story how he happens to be in prison, accused of murdering a police, a cop, right? Mm-hmm. And therefore, and they also want to give him the death penalty. Mm-hmm. I understand, which is about as serious as you can get.
Well, yeah, you don't get much more serious than the death penalty. March of last year, March 16th to be exact, in the community where he has established his mosque and where he at one point lived, an incident occurred involving two Fulton County sheriff deputies. Who was shot, one wounded, the other was fatally wounded. He was charged as the perpetrator of this crime. These charges so far have seemed to be without foundation, any real foundation. No evidence that we have seen thus far substantiates his being a suspect in this case. To the contrary, what we find is that some of the information that has been provided by the police themselves seem to suggest otherwise. One, from its earliest beginning, this story has been, this charge that they have leveled has been fraught with contradictions in terms of their explanation of the events that they said occurred on that evening of March 16th. Secondly, some of the specifics in terms of the individuals who were involved, namely the officer who survived and his identification of the suspect, conflicts with the basic physical traits in terms of Jamil. The officer basically has made a statement and signed a statement that the person who shot and wounded him and killed the other deputy was someone who had gray eyes. He went to great lengths to point out that the reason why he recognized the gray eyes was that his mother had always taught him to look a person in the eye, and he would never forget these steel, cold gray eyes. Well, you know, that very well may have been the perpetrator who did this. But the problem is that Jamil doesn't have gray eyes, never has had gray eyes. Even if he had gray eyes, you wouldn't know, because he's always worn dark glasses, even from when he was known as H.R.A.P. Brown. One of the distinguishing characteristics of him is that he wore these dark glasses, and he does so because he has to. Without those glasses, he couldn't hit the bond with a handful of sand. So there is one major, major kind of contradiction in terms of this case. The second one has to do with the blood. The officer who was killed and the officer who survived are certain that they wounded the perpetrator. When Jamil was captured, he had no bodily injuries at all. And so therefore, the whole question of it wasn't his blood that they said that they found that led to this blood trail. If it wasn't his and it wasn't the defendant, the victim's, then obviously it's somebody else's blood. And no attempt by the police was made to discover whose blood this was. So there is another major contradiction in the case. There are contradictions in the case in terms of what kind of vehicle was involved. Everything from a Chevy Impala to a Oldsmobile to a Cadillac to a Mercedes. So, I mean, it's almost a matter of take your pick. So I think that this case, just based upon what we have known today, it warrants that this case be revisited in terms of the charges that have been leveled against Jamil. Certainly, the death penalty needs to be dropped. Indeed, the whole charges need to be dropped on the basis of the fact that there is no evidence at all that has been offered to date that establishes him as the perpetrator of this crime.
Mm-hmm. And did they just police just go to his house and get him, or what happened?
The police indicated they were there to serve a bench warrant, which is unusual in this sense. And the usual process for serving a bench warrant, particularly for a case like this, is that the prosecutor calls an attorney, his attorney, and indicates to him that the defendant missed the court date and they would like for him to appear and would like the attorney to bring him in. This is not what happened. Instead, they showed up about 10 o'clock the night of the 16th with a warrant to arrest him. Now, the interesting thing is that because he's Muslim, prayer is a very rigid thing. It is organized around time. Even if you miss the time of the prayer, you're still obligated to go to the mosque to make the prayer. So one could reasonably conclude that he would be at the mosque at that and around that time, in and around that time. Why the officers, in my opinion, chose to, when they had all the other times in the world, even if they were going to come into the community, to come in the broader daylight, they chose to come at that particular time when it's dark, when it's a community that's a very vigilant community in terms of ensuring that there's no drugs and no prostitution, no drive-by shootings involved, that they would take that time in order to come and issue this warrant.
They went to the mosque.
They went to the mosque, right, to issue this warrant. It's a mystery.
Yeah. Well, of course, I know Jamil somewhat, and it just doesn't make any kind of sense in the world that somebody like him would run out and shoot a cop. It just is totally counterintuitive, I think, what they call it. But why would they want, they being the police or whoever, want to lock up Jamil Al-Amin, a former Rap Brown? I, of course, have my opinions about this, but I would like you to explain to the audience in the remaining little time we have here, because a lot of people don't even understand about how many political prisoners that there are in the United States and what kind of a history of locking people up who are innocent exists.
Jamil has been involved in this 35-year campaign that the government has launched against him in terms of harassment, prosecution, persecution, you name it. This has been going on for 35 years. It's documented in terms of his civil rights period by the whole COINTELPRO. He is actually named in that. We have seen the documents.
That's the FBI program to squelch the movement.
Yes, that's the FBI's program to squelch the movement through intimidation, through legal and bogus charges, through even murder. Okay? Now, so that prior to and during his civil rights activist, black power activist years, he was the subject of COINTELPRO. Now, COINTELPRO was supposed to have ended in the 70s. I contend that it didn't end. It just proceeded under a different name. And I think that what we're faced with now is the fact that because of his activities as a Muslim, not only in Atlanta, but the fact that he, as a national Muslim, in terms of organizing both foreign Muslims and African-American indigenous Muslims, his relationship on the international Muslim scene has created a grave concern on the part of the national security authorities about what and is his role and what is he doing and what is the relationship between Jamil Abdullah Al-Amin and so-called militant Muslim organizations? What is the relationship to Hamas, to Gaddafi, to the Sudan, etc., etc.? So I think that there is definitely a kind of hysteria and a paranoia that has been created. And I think that that is the backdrop under which all of this occurs.
Mm-hmm. And the kind of a Muslim organization tradition that Jamil is Al-Amin is involved in is not the Black Muslims, is it?
No, it's not the Nation of Islam. He is an Orthodox Sunni Muslim. You have various branches of Muslims in the international community. Sunnis, you have, there are about three or four of them, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's, and I know he's spent time in prison before. That's where he became a Muslim. So you are, I don't know if you're traveling around the United States, but anyway, you're here in the Bay Area right now to get support and money for lawyers and to put out the word about this case. So maybe this is time to give some information about what you want from people and some contact information, Ed Brown.
The first thing is that justice is not cheap in this society, as we have come to know. It only favors those who have the resources in order to go into the marketplace, buy the expertise that's necessary in order to exonerate people, people who are innocent. The second thing is that one of the things we must do is kind of repair the humanity of Jamil Abdul Al-Amin. They so marginalized his humanity in terms of the press coverage that he was simply reduced to being a thing. He was either a monster, he was simply a cop killer, he was simply an ex-Black Panther in the negative sense of the word. He was a cross between a thug and the Godfather. No recognition in terms of him in any other way. So part of what has to happen and part of what I'm trying to do is to say that what we're dealing with here is a human being who has all the dimensions of other human beings and cannot be reduced simply to being that kind of object that the state will kill or wants to kill. The second thing is that we need people to both be supportive of him financially, as well as in terms of as a political statement that says that we will not allow the state in our name to take this man's life, nor will we allow them to continue to take other people's lives in our name and call it justice. We've organized the Justice Fund. The P.O. Box is 93963, Atlanta, Georgia, 30377. I encourage those people who are lovers of justice and passionate about justice in order to support us in this effort.
Okay, I'm going to repeat that address. That's the Justice Fund, P.O. Box 93963, Atlanta, Georgia, 30377. And I want to thank you very much, Ed Brown, for speaking about yourself and about your brother, Jamil Al-Amin, who is a political prisoner at this moment.
And let me thank you, and let me thank your listeners. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for listening. I'm Sue Supriano.